Hey, welcome back to another edition of Old School Guns. This is episode 24, by my reckoning, which is a lot farther than we thought we'd get. We still have no sponsors, we're still not owned by anyone, and there's no network that's telling us what to say or do. So we're still completely independent, completely objective. As you know, this podcast is broken into basically three parts. And the first thing we like to talk about are general news items, and some of them are pretty applicable to Second Amendment issues. I like to talk about then gun culture media and things that we see out in the gun culture, whether it's YouTube providers, magazines, or some other medium. And then my favorite part is always questions and answers. And I get the questions from a variety of sources. Some of them are listeners. Some of them are people I know. And some of them are actually strangers who ask me questions if they find out I'm into guns and into shooting. And, you know, those are usually at public ranges or shooting ranges where I meet people. And we just kind of talk, and they ask me a question in the course of conversation. So that's where the three of those come from. Now, if you like this podcast and want to hear more of it, go ahead and hit the like button, hit the follower button, or hit whatever little button there is that Podbean know that you like what you hear. And when you do that, you'll get a advance notice when the next one posts. I think that's really more for the follower button. So if you follow me or subscribe, then you'll get a little alert when a new episode is posted. So anyway, let's get into it. The first thing I'd like to talk about is there was a gentleman in California, an older man, who had 1,000 guns in his house. And of course, being California, that was a real no-go. So they went in there and basically they busted him on some technical stuff. He had some short-barreled rifles, which you can't have in California, although I will get to that. And he had some handguns that apparently weren't transferred correctly. So they're busting him on that. And we kind of went through the thing on the last podcast. We talked about this case and essentially saying that, hey, if he lived in free America, there would be no real problem with this stuff. Just would have had to have had done a little paperwork for the short-barreled rifles. After the podcast, something occurred to me, and that is all that stuff could have been legal in California had he had some of the special permits that the state will issue people who support the movie business. So you can have things in California if you're connected to the movie industry, and if you're, I assume you'd have to be properly vetted to their satisfaction. But that stuff is attainable, but it's just for the select few, the people who the leadership in California deems worthy of having that. And face it, they're not going to chase the movie industry away over the gun issue. You know, it shows you that. And shows you how hypocritical they are, because certainly movie guns could be misused. But they're not going to chase it away. They're not going to chase away action films and everything else that exploit the use of guns, and in some case, the misuse of guns. They're not going to chase that away from their state and lose that revenue. So they will issue the license. If you are a place that rents to the movie studios, you're probably going to be okay. So this poor guy would have been okay if he had just rented to the movies and gotten himself a few licenses. He would have been good to go. Okay, the next thing is really kind of troubling, and on several different levels. First of all, our Congress, the House of Representatives, has embarrassed itself yet again. They look like complete fools. They called Robert Mueller, the investigator, the special investigator, whatever he is, the special counsel, I guess, and former special counsel, because his office is now closed. They called him up to so he could reiterate the garbage that's in his report, and it finds out that this old man doesn't even know what's in it. I mean, you know, I talk to people all the time, and this guy was out of it. You know, he was like, you know, you went and visited somebody in a in basically a home, you know? I mean, doesn't even know what's in his own report, had to have it pointed out to him. He really couldn't make any deductions on things. He was babbling. He was, you know, I mean, it was embarrassing. It was like they were harassing an old person that can't really defend themselves. And the fact of the matter is, he's a fool. He doesn't know the law. This is the old age version of Inspector Clouseau. And he has no idea what he was doing. First of all, collusion is not a crime. But if you're going to investigate it, okay, you investigate it. And there is no collusion. He even said there's no collusion. Well, if there's no collusion and there's no conspiracy, then there is no crime. And if there's no crime, there really is no obstruction. Now, if you don't like what the president says in public, that's fine, but that's not obstruction. They can call it that, but it's not. So there was no collusion, no conspiracy, no obstruction. And this guy couldn't even get it through his thick skull that, you know, we have the presumption of innocence in this country. You don't have to prove yourself innocent. The president does not have to prove that he did not obstruct justice. They have to just look at it and say, is there evidence to conclusively prove that he did? And they can't find it because it's not there. So he has the presumption of innocence. That is a basic fundamental part of our law. And the fact that Mueller doesn't get it and these congressmen don't get it leads me to believe, how can they understand something more complex like the Constitution? And the answer is they can't. They don't understand the Second Amendment. They don't understand the First Amendment. And I bet they don't understand any of the other amendments either. They really don't. I mean, they might be able to read them and parrot them like a ventriloquist dummy, which is about as smart as they are. But They really can't talk about it. And most of these people are lawyers. They've been to law school. Most of our politicians have been to law school. So, you know, it's incredible that they either can't or won't understand the basic parts of the law. So I think that's pretty disappointing. And I think that those were a circus. Fortunately, like everything else with this Inspector Clouseau Congress, it blew up in their face. And so that's just the way that is. So, you know, good luck to them. They're fools. And I hope they get lambasted in 2020. I really do. Clearly, the Democratic Party cannot be trusted with the House of Representatives, and it needs to be taken back from them and given to adults. Okay, the next thing is there was a letter published in support of Wayne LaPierre at the NRA. And, you know, it actually makes sense. It was on Ammo Land, I think. I saw it on Willis Lee's Facebook page. And it does make some sense. And it does make some sense to all the... It won't make sense to the LaPierre haters who are out there. But, you know, basically, okay, they probably did spend a lot of money on his suits. And that the number is actually in dispute. But let's just say for sake of argument, they spent $150,000, $200,000. I think that was actually his clothing and some travel together. So, you know, I don't think it was all clothes. But anyway, the guy has raised millions and millions of dollars, and they threw out some pretty heavy figures. And, you know, you could argue that, well, he could have worn cheaper clothes and still raised the same money. But, you know, when you're in the swamp, you have to operate in the swamp, and that means fancy clothes. If you're not treated like an important guy, you're not going to be taken as an important guy. The other thing that has been a criticism of Wayne LaPierre was the travel. And as I said in previous podcasts, hey, I know they move congressmen and senators on commercial planes. And I was on a plane one time when the glorious Attorney General under Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, was on the plane, and it was only about half full. So as she kept going up and down the aisle to go to the bathroom or whatever, I always made sure that I put my gun magazine, which I was reading, up high, so she knew what I was reading when she passed by. But, you know, they do that, but they also have a lot of security. And, You know, most people, even if you hate Janet Reno, you're not going to go hassle them. But Wayne LaPierre is probably going to get hassled. If he gets recognized, he might get hassled, and you're going to have a very ugly situation if security has to step in and slap some guy down because he's trying to attack Wayne LaPierre. So, yeah, he does probably have to move on charters, or if he can hitch a ride on a private jet, that's just as well. That's just the world we live in, man. The world we live in, nobody is really safe, and even on an airline, look at some of the weird people who are, you know, some of the weird cases, and they have them in the news every couple of weeks, somebody doing something strange or acting weird on a commercial aircraft, and that's the way it goes. You can't trust it, and you can't always throw these people out to the mercy of the public. But getting back to this letter, it was from one of the members of the NRA board, and basically they said, calm down over this stuff, you know, and just kind of look at the broader context, which is how much money has this man brought in, all these things. And that's where I think we want to hash this out. I think it has to be after 2020. And we got to secure a victory in 2020 and hopefully get the House of Representatives, you know, back or at least at parity so we can get some things through it and maybe get some relief for gun owners and kind of push victories forward. So that's where I'm at with that. I'm also seeing and this is a critique of the garbage you see on YouTube, you know, the pipsqueaks. And we said it's the Military Arms Channel dude. It's the gun websites guy. I think it's the We Like Guns or something. We Like Shooting or We Like Guns. Whatever that is, I think it's We Like Guns. And then there's some guy from the Firearms Policy Coalition or some nonsense like that, which I looked up on the internet and it appears to be just a place where you donate money. They don't seem to be doing anything. But these guys are always after the NRA, and I guess they held some big meeting among themselves after the NRA annual meetings. And essentially what they did is they're bad-mouthing and bashing the NRA. Then they're releasing these 10 and 12-minute segments of this stuff onto the YouTube, which is ridiculous. All I can say is if you're an NRA member, do not go to the next meeting and support jackasses like Ron Pincus or Rob Pincus, whatever his name is. Who's the other jackasses? The Military Arms jackass and some of these other guys. Don't support these jackasses. These guys have got long-standing grudges basically against the NRA, and they're using this as an opportunity to pile on. So they're fools. Don't support them. That's all you can really say. Okay. Hey, another thing that's popped up. InRange TV always has something interesting. Well, this time they took a DSA FAL, and they adjusted the gas system on it in one of the most, well, it's really not a very good video at all. I've shot FALs. I know how to adjust the gas system, and it's not as complicated as they were making it out to be. And one of the things I would say is, I think it's a lot smarter to adjust that gas system from from a bench, where it's more solid. You're not rocking with the recoil a little bit. The other thing, if you don't have a bench, then I would do it from prone supported, and definitely. You know, doing it from the shoulder just seems to me like it's just fraught with problems. And to get to a related point, when they actually use the FAL in a match after adjusting it, the first stage appeared to go fine. Then the second stage, they had some malfunctions. And I can't figure out. I looked at that. There's something about that looks wrong to me. Now, of course, it wasn't the usual two. It was Ian and this Russell Fagan guy, sinistral rifleman. And I don't know if they had problems with it because they're left-handers and maybe some of the controls, although they were used to them, they're just not optimized for it. Because, well, that's a different issue about the design of guns left-handed versus right-handed and is anything truly ambidextrous. But, you know, it just seemed to be weird. And the other part of it was, obviously this other guy they've got who looks like a big turtle in his armor and all the rest of it. He looks like a ninja turtle. I mean, he clearly wanted it to fail. I mean, he's clearly an AR gamer. And anything that's not an AR gamer gun, he's going to have problems with. And it goes back to the thing where I don't believe that you have to have a DD-214, meaning military service, to shoot and have fun and have opinions on military weapons. But I think it helps. And in this case, you can see where it didn't help. This is a civilian gamer guy. And I'm not sure that he really, you know, if you want something to fail, it will. And if you don't adjust something correctly, it will fail. I will also say that my Israeli FAL came from the manufacturer DSA perfectly set. I mean, I didn't change it because it's perfectly set. And I'm using Ball M80 equivalent ammo, which is fundamentally all about the same. It's fundamentally all about the same. They do have a point that, you know, it's funny, the people who love the FAL say, well, it's better because it has this adjustable gas system, and that allows you to shoot ammo anywhere in the world under the dirtier conditions, and blah, 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 blah. And it's better than the M14, because the M14 doesn't have that. Then when they're actually using it, they say, well, you know, I think this adjustable gas system is too complex, and it's too easy for people to monkey with, and it has to be adjusted just right, or the rifle doesn't work. So the thing that in one hand is looked upon as being this great, tremendous asset is now a liability, and maybe something simpler like an M14 gas system is a lot better. Then, of course, and of course you read the idiotic comments, and it's all, well, just DSAs are all trash. Well, I beg to differ, because mine certainly has been 100%. It's as good as anything FN made. It's as good as anything FN made. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that we have people who are used to AR. AR-15s are great rifles, and they're easy to shoot, and they are easy to maintain, and they're light, they're accurate. They have an incredible amount of positive attributes that the FAL does not. The FAL is a different gun. It's heavier. It takes a heavier cartridge. It's adjustable, so you can sell them from, you know, countries up in Scandinavia to countries down in equatorial Africa to countries out in deserts, and you can tune it for the type of ammo and maybe the type of environmental conditions that exist. So, you know, it's a different kind of rifle, and frankly, if you're in a position where you need a heavy rifle, an FAL is a very, very good choice. And I just kind of look at these guys, and, you know, I wonder what kind of, are they fantasy gamers or what? You know, they're dressed up in all the gear, but they're not the guys who walked the walk. You know, you didn't see this Russell Fagan character or this Ian McCollum guy or this Carl Carsada. You didn't see them over in the sandbox. And, you know, I'm not saying that all of anyone who ever went to the sandbox is a small arms expert, because people have different jobs, and with some of them they do very little with small arms. But, you know, for the grunts, the special operations guys and all that who use small arms really for their intended purpose, those are the guys who have the real deal experience. And it's not these guys who play dress up once a month for their matches. I mean, it's just not. So I really think these guys are, you know, they're just out there, and it's like, yeah, if you're running this little course that's essentially designed for an AR or designed for an AK, yeah, the FAL is going to be clumsier, and it's not going to be as easy. It's not going to have the quick follow-up shots and all the rest of it. But in a different context, it's a very excellent rifle. And in fact, a lot of the world's armed forces used it without any problems whatsoever. And in fact, it gave excellent service in Africa. People can talk about the Israeli experience, But really, it worked very well for the Israelis also. It worked very well for whoever had it. Is it perfect? Well, like any mechanical device, it's not, but it worked very, very well. So watching these kind of, it'd be like watching me trying to drive a Formula One race car. You know, even if I could drive it, I would probably only get a certain amount of performance out of it, simply because I am not fully trained. I am not anywhere near at the skill level where I would be using that piece of equipment. And in some ways, they're the same way. So, you know, I hate seeing shade thrown on a really good product by people who really aren't capable of rendering a deeply informed opinion. Okay, now we go to Guns of the Old West, which is a great magazine. I don't know if you've never picked it up, it's worth the read. It has historical stuff in it, and it also has the latest cowboy action, you know, stuff in there. And it's also got things that are not really cowboy action, but they're kind of related. And so, you know, the first thing I saw, I'm fumbling through this thing, you know, it's really kind of designed for a generation that's really a little more used to printed magazines as opposed to the internet, I think, because the demographic in cowboy action shooting is just a little bit older, and so the printed magazine is a very convenient, very familiar format for that age group. And I tell you what, though, I really enjoyed seeing there's a Peter Soli 1886 Winchester rifle. And I mean, I look at that and, you know, I immediately want one. I've always admired the Winchester model 1886. It's a tough, reliable, robust, powerful gun. It was really, I think, the greatest lever action. I think it just really was. And it was a Browning design. He really corrected every problem that was inherent in the earlier Winchesters, which was the weak toggle links. And this one looks like a first rate. The only thing that gives me pause is it's got the dreaded crescent butt plate, which probably okay in offhand shooting, but if you're shooting from any other position, you're just getting a big piece of, well, two pieces of metal that are stabbing into you with recoil. So I would be very, very leery of the crescent butt plate. If they have another version that's got a flat butt plate, I think I would probably opt for that. And in fact, Winchester themselves, or whatever company has bought the Winchester name, there really is no Winchester anymore. But who's ever got the license for their name? And I'm assuming they have it's Japanese made. They have the 1895 Winchester, which is a great gun, which is much more modern than even the 1886. And you know, it's you can feed it the military versions they had of that. You could feed with what we call stripper clips, magazine chargers. Doesn't have the tube magazine anymore. Doesn't worry about that. Really was optimized for you know, the new smokeless powder military style cartridges that came in starting in the 1890s. So the 1895 in 405 Winchester, and everybody I know who has one of those, and it's not that many, but it's a couple, and they say that is a real handful to fire, that it's got some recoil behind it. I would say that it's probably not considered a pleasant gun to shoot, but it's a very exciting gun to shoot because that's what Theodore Roosevelt shot lions with, and you know, it's requisitely powerful for that. So like a lot of powerful guns, this is not a casual shooting. You know, you don't take a 416 Rigby or something out and just go, you know, plink and shoot squirrels with it. I mean, it's a serious gun for serious purposes. And I noticed, though, it does have a flat butt plate, and it actually may even have a pad on it. I couldn't really tell from the photograph, but it looks like it may have a pad on it. But it looks like a very, very cool gun, and I'm assuming it's probably Japanese made. You know, Japan has been turning out Winchester copies, and thanks for Browning, Winchester copies for Browning, and a lot of those kind of things for a very long time. So I assume that's where it's coming from. And those are very, very high quality guns. So I was pretty pleased to see that. Would I buy either one? I would only if I, you know, that's a very difficult thing to say. I don't really do any kind of, and these are not cowboy action guns because you need pistol caliber carbines for that. These would be guns that if you were a traditional hunter or you had a cabin out in the woods that you like to frequent and be around, but there could be bears, could be mountain lions, something like that. I think that, you know, those would be great guns to have for that, especially if you love traditional guns, as I do. So I would buy them for that. As range toys, I think they would spend more time in the safe. And, you know, again, it's one of those guns that would wind up going out about every 2 years because, you know, it's probably not that much fun to shoot, but it's going to be a really interesting gun to have and a really interesting gun to, you know, tote around the woods or something and feel that you know, you have really an excellent rifle that can handle, you know, any situation you'd run across vis-a-vis hunting or animals out in the woods. Now, on the silly side, they have the Alaskan Hoda pistol, which is the Pedersoli Alaskan Hoda, which is their Hoda pistol, which was a 410 45 Colt. You know, it's a double barrel, looks like, you know, kind of looks like almost like a double rifle that's been cut down to a pistol or manufactured as a pistol. But this one is chrome, has got some sort of satin chrome or hard chrome finish, I should say, and has got rubber stocks on it. You know, frankly, why would you do that? As a two-shot gun, I mean, even something with not a very good reputation like the Taurus Judge or the Smith & Wesson Governor would be a better choice if you want to shoot 410 or 45 Colt. Having a two-shot pistol would be ridiculous. And nothing about that says that would be a good choice in Alaska to have. You're much better off with a heavy magnum revolver, 44 magnum and up. You know, one has to think that a Freedom Arms 454 Casal would be a much, much better choice than this. So that's in the silly part. The other thing is, on the back page, there's an advertisement for probably one of the coolest range toys, the Tippmann Armory 9mm Gatling Gun. So, you know, of course, these things are absolutely, they have no real use other than they're just fun to play with. And at a public shooting range, it would probably be problematic, very problematic. But, you know, if you own the property and, you know, everybody loves Gatling guns, you know. This looks the part of a Gatling gun. I mean, it's not exact, but it looks the part. It looks very, very well made, very nice. And being 9mm, you can afford to shoot it. You know, the problem with most Gatling guns are they're for cartridges that are pretty expensive. Or there are actually percussion Gatling guns, the very earliest models, which had what they called a chamber, which was like imagine kind of a iron shell casing that you would put a percussion cap on one end and put the powder and ball in, and it would fire it almost like a cartridge, and then these things would fall out the bottom and then you could load them again, you know. So but this would be a 9mm, which is very inexpensive and would be a lot of fun to shoot. It would be a lot of fun to have, but again, you have to really wonder, and there are a lot of guns that fall into this category. When the cool factor and novelty wears off, what do you really have? And I do have to say that, you know, the people I know who've bought things like this, and I know one guy who bought a semi-automatic M2 50 caliber, it's like, what's the cool factor wears off? This thing's either going to sit in the safe or it's going to get sold because it's something you take out every 2 years because cleaning an M2 50 caliber is not a fun chore. It's not a lot of fun. And hauling something around that's got a 75-pound receiver, then you've got the barrel and all the other stuff that goes with it, tripod, pintle, T&E, and all the rest of it. you know, it's only going to go out every couple of years. Same thing with the guys who own some of these Class 3 machine guns. You wonder why some of them don't function. Well, it's because they never get taken out, because it's a real pain to take out a water-cooled machine gun. Is something that you're going to devote an entire day to taking out, setting up, getting it going. And then when you bring it home, then you're going to go through the cleaning routine, and the disassembly and assembly of these things are more complex than standard small arms. So it's a big endeavor and a big commitment. And that's why those things, you know, they're very, very cool, and you go, wow, I'd like to have one of those. They're very, really neat, but the practicality issues really will come and bite you in the rear. But it looks like this small 9mm Gatling gun would be a bit more manageable. Although, you know, again, what are you really going to do with it besides burn ammo and plink and other things? And I think that they're actually pretty moderately priced for a Gatling, which can go up to, originals are fantastically expensive, and the reproductions that look like the originals, I think, can go for $30,000 to $50,000. And I think this Tippmann one goes probably for under four to five something. But it's also the down payment on a car too, so you have to kind of look at it that way. Okay, here comes my favorite part of the show: questions and answers. And from one of our very good friends of the podcast, and this guy, he is going to get on this podcast one way or another. Very interesting guy. Grew up in a country south of here, way south of here. Lived through some very interesting times, and including some police interrogations and a few other things that would really be interesting to hear about first person. But anyway, his question, which really caused some thought on my part, was, when guns appear in movies, does that really affect their prices? When the gun is highlighted or showcased in a movie, does that affect their prices? Now, when I first read this, I thought, hey, I kind of answered that obliquely when it said, hey, have I ever been influenced by a movie to buy a gun? And I kind of said, well, not really, you know. But I think it's cool when some of the guns I like or have been showcased in a movie. I think that's very cool. But I looked upon that and I said, you know, there's something deeper here that he's getting at. And here's what he's really getting at is, do movies have the ability to influence audiences enough, the gun enthusiast audience enough, to really affect prices? And I have to say, yes, in several ways. And I'm going to try to organize my thinking here a little bit. I would say first, you have the Smith & Wesson Model 29 phenomenon, which was Dirty Harry used it, everybody wanted it, and so the gun became very, very scarce. And the gun was trading, it was punching above its weight, I would say. If the gun cost $400 back in the early 70s, you know, people were getting 600 for them because there was a demand. And when the demand is high and the supply is constant or low, the price is going to go up. So, yes, it did. And for years, and we're talking years, the Smith & Wesson Model 29 was a very difficult gun to get. It went on the shelf, and it was off the shelf into somebody's hands. Somebody would purchase it very shortly thereafter. So, yes, In that case, where it created such a demand that the supply could not keep up, it did change it. Now, before Dirty Harry, you could walk into gun shops or places that sold guns, and you could see Model 29s on the shelf if they were a Smith & Wesson dealer, because it was looked upon as kind of a hunter gun, and it had steady but not really dynamic sales. So that one movie did change that whole thing. And it did probably jack up the price about 33%. And it wasn't really until the 1980s that Smith & Wesson caught up. And then there were other guns which had become very popular from the movies. Another case are not so much a single firearm, but a class or a group of firearms. And you could say that after Saving Private Ryan came out in 1997 or 1998, I can't remember which, the interest in World War II era weapons, especially the U.S. stuff, especially airborne unit equipment, you know, like the folding stock carbines, especially 1911 pistols, especially M1 rifles, especially, you know, BARs by extension. These things, the World War II U.S. GI weapons, skyrocketed, and they just did. It wasn't too long ago that back in the early 90s, back in the 80s, you could buy an O3A3 for $100 to $200. They didn't cost that much. Then all of a sudden, they're $500 and $600. Anything USGI was way up there. And, you know, you kind of see some climbing of the prices of the German things, too. Lugers have always been high, but you see things like Walther P-38s, which were fairly common, the wartime production P-38s. They all became much higher priced, and that was due to Saving Private Ryan, the interest that all has created in that particular era of weapons. The same thing happened on a smaller scale when the movie The Rough Riders came out, which is almost at the same time. And then interest in the Krag carbines especially really started to soar. That plus the centennial anniversary of the Spanish-American War. So definitely movies did move the price quotient on all those guns up very, very much. Other ones that have always kind of been an influence, we've mentioned the James Bond films, and the PPK has always done that. It seems like they showcase every movie that showcases kind of a different gun. It may not affect the price, but its popularity may go up. I think when you see Die Hard, Bruce Willis's Beretta 92, that helped the Beretta 92 become better known and in some ways more accepted. I don't really think it affected price because there was never an issue of the demand just outstripping the supply. So in some cases, especially historical weapons that aren't made anymore, like you know, the World War II weapons or Spanish-American War weapons, you definitely can see where there's a fixed amount of them, the demand goes up, definitely it happens. And people are susceptible to the commercial image of the movies. And I would say that this has happened to a degree with the Desert Eagle. I don't know that the Desert Eagle would always have some sort of following, but I would wager that some of its popularity is based on the fact it's been used in TV shows and movies. And people see it, they're familiar with it, they like it, they think it's cool, and they want to own something cool. And that plus the fact it's technically a very excellent gun. It's very, very excellent. So a lot of people would definitely, I think, agree that, you know, when you really examine it, yes, movies do affect gun prices, and it can be for a group of firearms, it can be for a single one, and that is definitely it. And it'll be interesting to see how video games can do the same thing. Video games may be able to do the same thing. I don't know. It would be very interesting to me, and maybe this is the test case. Maybe some of the interest in retro ARs is due to Vietnam era movies or movies that are set in that particular period where the you know, maybe the movie Platoon, maybe, you know, We Were Soldiers, maybe some of these ones that showcase the M16A1 or earlier M16s, maybe definitely that's part of what's fueling the retro market. Who knows? Haven't seen anything that says that, but I've seen nothing that denies it. It would be very cool if there was an action movie that had a trigger charging handle AR like the Brownells Proto AR, and it'd be interesting to see if the sales of those skyrocket because a movie came out which showcased it. Okay, here is another question. The M1 Garand, or Garand as some people say, versus the STG-44. Which was the best rifle of World War II? And again, you can't, that's very difficult to answer. I would say that it depends on the armies using them. For the Germans, semi-automatic rifles were problematic for them to develop in full caliber. And they would have been well served by a gun that had the capabilities of an M1. They had some things that were close, but not quite the reliability and durability of an M1. They would have been well served with that. The reason they went with the STG was it had advantages that outnumbered troops really liked: high capacity, it was effective out to the combat ranges they needed it to be, and all the rest. We talked about the STG last podcast, and how the U.S. Army kind of didn't get it when they saw these things. The M1 for worldwide use, which is what, if you're in the U.S. Army in World War II, you have to look at worldwide use. You have to look at the islands up in Alaska that you're going to take back from the Japanese. You have to look at the jungles of New Guinea. You have to look at the deserts of North Africa. And then you have to look at the soggy, wet mountains of Italy. And then you have to look at the coast of France and pushing inland in Central Europe. So you have to look at all those places and say, what is the best all-around rifle? And the M1 filled that brilliantly. And that plus our tactics were a little bit different. You know, we had a better volume of fire, so there wasn't this burning need for the an STG-like weapon, because we already had good firepower. Maybe not the best, but good firepower. And so I would say it depends on the army that was using it. It also depends on the ranges you're using it. An STG in North Africa would have been a lot less popular than something that could reach out and touch. The same way that 7.62 NATO weapons found a niche in Iraq and Afghanistan, where, you know, the range might be 600 yards as opposed to 300 yards, and a weapon that can reach out and touch beyond that 300-yard zero, or beyond that 300-yard range where you're expected to make that hit, is a good thing. So, you know, it depends on where you are, where you're fighting, what part of the war. They really didn't have any STGs in North Africa with the Germans. They didn't. So, but in cities or in some built-up area, they're very, very good. So, anyway, I think the M1 was the best all-around rifle. The STG was probably the best rifle for certain areas, and I think it was really tailored for the combat they were fighting on the Eastern Front. I think it did a great job there. But you really have to take the hands off to the M1. Great, great weapon, great service record, and you know, it's still held in very, very high esteem today. Okay, this came from a colleague at work. If you had to select a bolt-action service rifle cartridge, what would it be? And the genesis of this question is, you're from a fictional country, well, the fictional country of Hidalgo in South America. And, you know, it's basically 1930s, bolt actions are the only things really out there available to you. So what are you going to choose? What are you going to choose? And I think I would go with what most South Americans and the Mexicans did. I think 7mm Mauser was probably the best. And I say that because I don't really care for the recoil of an 8mm Mauser. I just don't care for that in a bolt gun. 7mm guns seem to be a lot more civilized. I can get quicker follow-up shots. It's very powerful, very lethal. A really good round. 6.5s. The thing that makes me leery of 6.5s, and you got 6.5 Swede, 6.5 Carcano, and 6.5 Japanese. And the thing that makes me leery about those is both the Japanese and Italians wanted to dump their 6.5 cartridge rifles because they felt that they didn't have the lethality that they were looking for. Now, 7mm is not that much larger, but it seems to be a lot more effective. Now, does this translate into anything modern? No. This is simply just a historical example of, I would not choose a rifle with a rim cartridge. I would not choose 303 British or 7.62x54. The rimmed cartridges are out. The 30-06 is always a great choice, but it's got some recoil, but it's a great choice. 8mm, even though I've just kind of dogged it a little bit, is still a great choice. Served the Germans and countless others fine. But I think I would prefer the 7mm Mauser. So that's the one I would choose. And, you know, you'd buy rifles from anybody, basically. You could even go to Spain and they could make you rifles and that. So I think that's what I would choose. Okay, the next question is, what are Holy Grail guns and do you have one? Okay, what Holy Grail gun is simply just a slang terminology, and it means a gun I've always wanted and I've been searching for, and they're very difficult to find. Holy Grail guns for a person can be a lot of different things. It can be anything they want. It's usually a rare model or a model that had some nostalgic value to them that's hard to find. So that's what a Holy Grail gun is. I've been looking for one of these for years is another way of saying that it's a Holy Grail gun. I have the ultimate Holy Grail gun, the ultimate. And that is, I have the 1911 pistol my grandfather carried in the trenches during the First World War. I heard about it as a kid. I didn't know who had it. As it turned out, somebody in the family had it. And when I was a young man, old enough to be responsible and have it, and I was starting military service, it was gifted to me. So that is the ultimate Holy Grail gun for me. There's that, I call it the jewel, because that's what it is. And there's, you know, it's nothing sets it aside from any other, you know, 1911 World War I era gun, but the history and the sentimental value make it the Holy Grail gun. If I could only have one gun, and for years I wished I wanted that gun. I said, I think it exists somewhere, and I was right, and I had it. So that was my Holy Grail gun. Okay, next. Do you have experience with the 30-40 Krag? Yes, I do. The Krag is a very, very nice cartridge. It does have a rim, and it is a great cartridge to fire. It's a fun cartridge to hand load. It works very well in a variety of different actions, single shots, lever guns, and bolt actions. It's a great round. It's really it's powerful enough, but it's very pleasant to shoot. Very nice, very hard to find ammo for these days, though. The Krags are just, Krags are tough. I mean, and that's very puzzling to me, because for years, Krags were sporterized, and it's really a shame. You know, a lot of Krags were kind of butchered up and turned into hunting rifles, kind of as home gunsmithing projects. So they're not necessarily the most beautiful hunting rifles, but I'm sure there are some exceptions to that, but the vast majority of them were sold cheap, they were effective, and the first thing people seem to want to do is cut the wood off and shorten the barrels. So the Krag is a very, very good rifle, a lot of fun to shoot, and that's my experience with it. I've done some hand loading for it, but not a tremendous amount, because the components and everything is very difficult to come across. But it's a very pleasurable gun, and it's a gun that if you inherit guns from, say, 1920 to like 1950, if you have access to guns from that era, you will run across probably a sporterized, or if you're very fortunate, a full military Krag. In full military condition, as issued condition. There were also some odd ones made by Bannerman, you know, kind of pieced together with different sites, and there were NRA specials that were put out World War I era. So there's a lot of different varieties out there. So you really got to know what looks like it might be a butchered Krag could be, in point of fact, a rare variation. I think there was a Philippine constabulary carbine, all kinds of different things that are out there that you could run across, but the run-of-the-mill crag you're going to see is probably a good chance it's been sporterized and or left in its original military condition. And the rare variants are pretty tough to run across. But they all shoot very, very well. Quality of manufacture was exceptionally high. You know, they were hand-fitted. They're very, very smooth. Everybody really likes them. And in fact, most military shooters that were competing in the even in the nascent national matches back then did not really want to give up the Krag for the Springfield. And we think of the Springfield as kind of the ultimate national match target gun. But in fact, the Krag was a very, very popular and well-liked rifle. And one of the cool things is if you saw the AMC series of The Sun, one of the characters there had a Krag carbine that was used in several sequences, Krag cavalry carbine. So it's kind of cool to see that. I like seeing that kind of variance and authenticity in television productions. Shows me somebody's actually in their thinking and not just, you know, grabbing something off the prop shelf and throwing it in an actor's hands. And another cool part about that is that when you have an unusual gun like that, usually the actor has got to get a little bit of training in it, kind of figure out how it works and all that. And that's icing on the cake, makes it a much more enjoyable thing for a gun enthusiast to watch. So anyway, that's the last question. And this is the end of this episode of Old School Guns. Again, if you like us, go ahead and hit one of the buttons that shows you like us and want to follow us. If you hate us, go ahead and leave a few comments. And if you have any other questions, please, you can give them in the comments. That's the best place because I check those routinely. And I will get to your questions. So anyway, this is Old School Guns, out.